morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We are now going to return to Yah's Torah testimony. We are considering the words that he used to explain his introduction to humankind. Barashit Elohim, Bara Eth HaShamayim, Wa Eth HaEretz. It means in English, in the beginning, the Almighty accordingly created the spiritual world and also the material realm. As we have been doing these this last week of programs, we're going through and gleaning as much information as we can from each of the words that made this initial statement. The word we are examining now is bara. It is the lone verb in this opening statement. It was translated created, but a word of warning here, created as in past tense, has no position in Islam. Excuse me, in Hebrew. Boy, I've still got Islam on the brain. Excuse me for making that blunder. But I was reading during the break that that of the Islamist jihadists that murdered the 37 non-Muslims in the terrorist attack on the Algerian oil facility, that two of the Muslim jihadists, two of the terrorists, were actually Canadians. Goes to show that that it isn't about nationality, it isn't about being Arab racially. The problem is the religion. It has nothing to do with the nationality, has nothing to do with race, has all to do with religion. Well, now with that off the top of my mind, let me return to the translation of bara as created. There is no past tense in Hebrew. So since there is no past tense in Hebrew, there is no present tense, there is no future tense. In Hebrew, verbs are not stuck in time as they are in English. In English, we position a verb as either in the past tense, the present tense, or in the future tense, or derivatives of each of these. But that is not the case with Hebrew. So we cannot discern from this statement as to whether or not God has completed the act of creation. He could still be creating, because to render a verb in one particular position has no basis in Hebrew. Also, I think he is still not only still creating, but he's going to create an entirely new universe going forward.
Well, that's true.
So, yeah. God, and it's also the only reason that he created the universe in the first place, and is creating this universe, is so that he can enjoy the company of men and women, children in his covenant family. The whole purpose of enjoying a family is to be able to create the memories of relationship, create the experiences of relationship, to help those individuals grow and become more than they otherwise would be. So I think that the creative process is absolutely ongoing. In ancient Hebrew, bara is written with a bereth, which is the Hebrew word for family and home, reemphasizing this fact. The rosh in Hebrew is depicted by showing a human head, so identifying the tools that we can use to enter this home. This home, by the way, is depicted as the floor plan of a house. That's how the letter was initially drawn. It has one way in, and we are encouraged to use our heads first. God is letting us know who is invited into his home, people, and what we should deploy to find the entrance, which is our heads. Our eyes to observe, our ears to listen, our mouths to respond, our brains to process the information. And then also with the with Rosh, we learn that this is God's first priority, that this home is his first priority. and it should be ours. The last letter in bara, this initial verb, is an aleph. The aleph was drawn in the form of a ram's head. It is the first letter in Ab family. It is the first letter in El God. It identifies whose home this is, and it also provides information in terms of the benefit of entering this home, because Aleph not only conveys the identity of our Heavenly Father, who is God, but also that we will be empowered in this environment. So those are all insights that we can glean from bara. And it's, of course, interesting, as we have learned, that if you look at the characters that comprise the original script, the font, if you will, that the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms were written in, you don't have to be literate in the sense of recognizing the shapes of characters and their phonetic sound to be able to read and benefit from this testimony. Because all of this message was conveyed using pictures that even a child would understand. And yet, these graphic representations of concepts provide insights that the smartest among us is incapable of plumbing the full import of the message that is being conveyed to us. Now, Larry, as you know, at the end of our program on Friday, we were investigating how bara was used in Scripture, particularly when it reappears in the Torah. And the point that I was making by citing the discussion that takes place in the book called Shemot, it's the second book of the Torah. You know, we're reading the opening account from the book of Bereshith, which means in the beginning. It's been changed to Genesis. Well, the second book is about Shemot, which is Exodus. The covenant is initially presented in the book of Bereshith, but the beneficiaries of the covenant are reunited with the spiritual father, God, of the covenant in the book of Shemot, which we call Exodus. And so, while the letters that comprise bara are clear enough, telling us that this verb was being used to say that God was not just creating the universe, but he was creating his covenant, what we find is that when bara as a verb reappears in the Torah, it is used in direct harmony with the establishment of the covenant. And in the 10th verse of the 34th chapter of Exodus is where we find that juxtaposition of karat, which means to cut or create, the bereth covenant, and bara, used in conjunction with one another. We were sneaking up on that verse, trying to understand it in context, recognizing that context really is the mother's milk of understanding. And so let's begin by reviewing the 7th verse from Friday's program. There we read, loyal love and unfailing kindness, which is chesed, spares, protects, and preserves, natsar. Natsar is this marvelous term that is equal parts observation and salvation. You know, shamar is the Hebrew word for observation, and yasa is the Hebrew word for salvation. And so yasha and shamar are blended together in the natsar, and what it speaks of is that this loyal love and unfailing kindness saves those who are observant, so that thousands, and this is Aleph, learn to be lifted up and forgiven from guilt. So here is the Torah presenting mercy to those who are observant, saving thousands by lifting them up and forgiving them from guilt. So rather than the Christian notion of the Torah condemning and being incapable of saving, as it is presented in Paul's letters, God says that his mercy spares, protects, and preserves thousands who learn and lifts them up and forgives them from their guilt. Also, this is not just any kind of guilt. It is awon. Awon is that which distorts, that which perverts, that which twists. And so it is corruption. Our English Bible translations, for example, are twisted. They're distorted. They are corrupted. Christianity is a counterfeit, therefore a twisting and a corruption of the truth, as is the religion of Judaism. And so the Torah's, Yahweh's mercy, as depicted in the Torah, spares and saves those who are observant and who are willing to learn what he had to say. And the quantity of those who are spared is depicted quantitatively as thousands who are lifted up and forgiven from this form of corruption, this awon, this type of guilt. They're also spared from rebellion. And ultimately, it is our revolt against God that gets us into trouble. Yes, it is corruption that is beguiling that leads us to the point where we are tripped. But, you know, just receiving, being in the presence of a distortion, a perversion of God's testimony, as you would be if you were in a church service, isn't sufficient to cause you to be on the wrong side of the covenant unless you are willing to resist, to rebel against, to oppose Yah's presence, testimony, and solution. The third thing that we are forgiven from, the third thing that we are lifted out of, is missing the way. There is but one way into God's home. That is a path that he has provided through, that begins with the doorway of Passover, leads through, over the threshold of unleavened bread, where at the first date we become immortal, the second we become perfect, so that on the third step along this way, we are adopted into God's family on Bukurim, on first fruits, and then we are empowered and enriched as his children on Shavua, which is the promise of seven, seven sevens later. The fifth step is then Teruah, which speaks of those who have been so enriched and inspired, so empowered, shouting out a warning that others might hear, might listen to, might respond to, which leads to the day of reconciliation, Yom Kippurim, and ultimately to camping out with God, to Sukkah, as the seventh step, the essence of God's plan and purpose. I'm Yada. We'll be back with Larry in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We're joined by Larry, calling in from Florida. We're reading a statement from the Torah that is one of my favorites because it blends so many important concepts together. We're almost completed with it, but let me take it again from the beginning. It speaks of loyal love, unfailing kindness, and mercy. This is from the Hebrew chesed. Spare, protect, and preserve the observant from Natsar, so that thousands learn from Aleph to be lifted up and forgiven from. And then there's a list of the things here. The first of them is that we are forgiven in this way by Yahweh's mercy to save thousands, forgiving them from Awon, which is distortion and corruption. This speaks of religion, of rebellion, which is our personal revolt against God, where we choose to ally ourselves with human institutions, with trusting political institutions or religious institutions or academic institutions or economic institutions or even the military, when we ally ourselves with them as opposed to with God. That is a way of rebelling against God. It's a pesha in Hebrew. The third thing on the list that God is forgiving us from by way of his mercy, at least those who are observant, is missing the way. There is one way to God. It is a seven-step process which we reviewed at the end of the last segment. And then it concludes this. It says, becoming pardoned and going unpunished. So if you are observant and you are a beneficiary of Yah's mercy, and among the thousands who are willing to learn from his Torah teaching, you will be forgiven from corruption, awon, guilt, rebellion, pasha, and chata, missing the way, becoming pardoned, going unpunished, being vindicated, considered innocent. This is Shemoth names, Exodus 34:7. It's pretty hard to equate that or to be aware of that statement and embrace Pauline doctrine, is it not, Larry?
Well, it would be almost impossible because Pauline doctrine has, you know, an entire assemblies of people being saved, you know, to where you got, you know, billions or at least hundreds of millions.
Yes. The other challenge you'd have here also with religions like Christianity, of where there's a couple of billion adherents, is that Yahweh quantified the number of individuals that would observe him, come to focus on and consider his mercy and learn from his Torah teaching, and he quantified them as elef in the thousands. And this is not the only place he does this. There are at least three places that I know that God specifically quantifies the beneficiaries of his mercy. Another is on the first of the two tablets. He talked about fathers, awon, corrupting their children and their children's children, and his mercy being available to elef, thousands. And there he says it's the mercy is available to thousands who observe the terms and conditions of his covenant.
Yada, don't you think, though, that I mean, this is my thinking here. I can be wrong. I think that's directly pointing to Teruah. And I realize that Teruah has now been corrupted in Judaism to be the Babylonian head of the year, Rosh Hashanah. But I say mercy because, you know, it isn't exactly experiencing mercy when you go through 7 years of hell on earth. You know,
what Larry is doing here is trying to quantify how you get to thousands when there may be a massive reconciliation of Yisrael and Yehudim, if you will, upon Yahweh's return.
Because two-thirds dead. But, you know, when you look at the population of Yisrael, that you're up around 6-7 million, and it might be greater than that, you know, by the time. Saying then we're into, as far as mercy, we must be talking about Teruah, I think. I mean, you can assure your thoughts.
There's several things here. One is that that today, my guess is that in terms of those who have embraced the covenant, who understand the five terms and conditions of the covenant, who understand that there is one way to God, and it is the seven steps that begin with Passover and end with the celebration of Sukkah.
If you're to believe
camping out.
That's absolutely true.
That based upon that, there's probably one in a million people today that has benefited from Yah's mercy in the way that he prescribed. So the numbers work beautifully in that regard. And if you go back in time, I think the numbers would be even fewer until you go all the way back to the children of Yisrael who first heard this message. We'll return to this thought in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering this concept of thousands relative to being recipients of Yah's mercy. It's a statement that Yah etched in stone, saying that fathers would corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation, and so that his mercy would be available to thousands, and that those thousands who receive it would be in similar situations to these here in this statement in the Torah. They would be those who observe the terms and conditions of his covenant. And so what Larry is saying, and it's a valid point, that there are times when it appears that that it could be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, who are beneficiaries of Yah's mercy. all at one time. So how does the thousands play into that? And as I was thinking about it, Larry, if you kind of go all the way from the time that Adam and Chawa were sent out of the garden to the time that Yahweh went into Egypt with Moshe to rescue his children, that it could well have been that there
were people receiving mercy by then.
Yeah, that thousands could cover that entire period of thousands of years.
You got Noah,
right,
and his family.
Right.
You have examples. And these are small groups of people.
Right. Yeah, and even with Abraham and his direct family and his immediate descendants, small groups of people.
And then who apparently came around.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah, Adam and Chawas, yeah. And then during the time that Yahweh makes himself so prevalent as he is enacting in history, His means of salvation, which is the same seven-step plan that begins with the Passover. While there were many thousands who rebelled and didn't make it through the wilderness, and while most of those who were originally rescued were to die in the wilderness and never come into the promised land because they did not embrace Yahweh, even though he was there among them and was active saving them, you would think that it would be... Of that group, the number who embraced the covenant would be more than just a handful of thousands. So is a possibility that the thousands were in any one kind of period of time, going back to this notion that Hebrew is not restricted to time and not stuck in time. And then during the time that Yahusha was here, in his sixth visit, when he was fulfilling Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah in our midst, year 4000 Yah, 33 CE on our pagan calendars, you know, you would assume that as a result of what he did at that time, that there would have been thousands of individuals who would have embraced him and the Torah's teaching at that time. Now, if you go forward in time from then, you've got so much corruption and perversion by the creation of the Christian religion and by the growth of rabbinic Judaism that over the ensuing, most of the ensuing 2,000 years, I would think there would be very few that would have formed a relationship with Yah. Then you're dealing now in a period of time where we have wonderful tools. We have access to the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have wonderful tools in terms of providing us access to the earliest manuscripts for the Christian New Testament, so that we know that it's not trustworthy, and we have marvelous lexicons and interlinears. So we're in a position once again where we can really dig into what he said and come to understand it. And I think there are thousands who are benefiting from that. But then
I think that you could well be right. So you're saying split up in each time zone.
Right. Whatever. Right. Yeah. Because you know, again,
time, if you will.
Right. Right. It could be over 40 Yobel periods of time. But then, and you're going to get to this harvest, which is Teruah, which is going to take place on one of the remaining 20 Teruah's celebrations between now and the beginning of fewer than that. It's 20 to the end of time. So it's only 13 remaining between now and the beginning of the tribulation, where Yah's mercy will spare those who are children of the covenant, so they don't have to endure the tribulation. And so that will again be in the thousands. But there appears to be a very large number who will endure the tribulation, but will come to be reconciled in their relationship with Yahweh at the very end of the tribulation. In the year 2033 in our pagan calendars, year 6000 Yah, where we do learn that two out of every three Jews, Israelites, are killed during the 7 years of the tribulation. And we're never told that all of the remaining Yehudim and Israelites embrace the covenant and Yahweh at its termination. But it does appear that the vast preponderance do, and that could be millions. Certainly could be in the hundreds of thousands. And so there are some considerations in terms of how all of that worked together throughout time. We have Rod calling in from Indiana. Hello, Rod. I understand you have a question on the thousands saved.
Does that come from the Dead Sea Scrolls translations, or is that from Masoretic sources? If it's from Masoretic sources, well, then you might have to consider the source.
The statement regarding what is the first of you know, there's three statements that are etched on the first of the two tablets. And then on the second of the two tablets, there's seven instructions. The statements that are etched on the first of the two tablets are repeated five or six different times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. There's a recap of them, for example, in Devarim. And in Devarim, that is the book that we have the most copies of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so this message that we're talking about here, having the Aleph, the Hebrew word for thousands, it is extant in many places in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's extant in many places in the Torah. So I don't think we can ascribe it to a Masoretic copy edit in this particular case. The only wiggle room that we have in LF is that there is a different vocalization of LF that is vocalized Aleph, written the same way, but in that case, it both speaks of thousands, but also of learning. And so, you know, God could be here speaking of the thousands who learn from his Torah, who he is, and embrace the covenant, and then dealing with the reconciliation of Yehudim at the end, where it's not so much a learning exercise as it is the experience that they have endured. And the return of Yah, just, you know, Eureka, all of a sudden they get it. And so it may be just thousands actually think their way through his Torah. But it's lots of different places.
Yeah, but it may also be the word mercy, because you're dealing with, it's hard to call it mercy when you had to have a brick bat hit you in the head.
Okay, right. I've got another question here. Sorry for jumping back in, but
sure.
You have talked about initially the people that Yahweh deals with individually, and I can definitely see that in the neighborhood of thousands. But what about those thousands that have relatives and family and friends that they have interacted with? Isn't it possible that those people who are in the believe the initial group will then turn around as first fruits and work with the people that they themselves have interacted with throughout their life? I realize
there's a possibility.
Yeah.
That's a possibility. But, you know, I want you to also keep in mind here that while that would increase the number from thousands to tens of thousands, because the thousand took the time to learn and to be observant, and they shared and they taught thousands more, you'd still be up into the range of tens of thousands. But I would concur with that there's certainly room for that. It's what God tells us constantly is that once we study and learn what the Torah reveals, that we are to share it with our children and take every opportunity to do so in our homes so that they come to embrace the same teaching. Now, that said, I think you know, and Yosha made this point very clear, and he made it often, that the vast majority of family members are going to reject the truth. That if a member of a family comes to know the truth, it's very frequent that the majority of their family rejects it. So, I think what we've got here still is is it reemphasizes what Yahusha said in his Sermon on the Mount, which is that very few people find the door to life, which is Passover, and that the vast majority of people follow the more broad and popular routes to the death and destruction of their soul. So I think it's a message here that if you're dealing with a popular, prevalent religious or political institution, you can be assured that they are not going to be the beneficiaries of Yah's mercy.
Oh, I agree with that. I have one other thing that I'm thinking of right now, and that is in Yahochanan, Book of John, I believe it's 6:44, Yahusha is quoted as saying that no man can come to me unless the Father draws him. Is this something that's been written in? It wasn't originally in the... is that originally in the... is that something that's been added by scribes later on that you know of? I know you might not have it.
Well, the problem with everything in the Christian New Testament is that most everything was written and spoken in a language other than the language that we're considering it in, and Yahusha spoke Hebrew and Aramaic, and all we have is Greek copies of Yahochanan. But beyond that, just think about it for a moment. There is a different perspective that I would like to enjoin on you as it relates to that statement that does not make it such that God is choosing who can be a member of his family. God's testimony to us, his speaking to us, is the sum total of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Unless you come to know who Yahusha is, unless you come to embrace what Yahusha has done, from the perspective of God. Hello and welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. Rod from Indiana had a call, and I did in the break have the opportunity to look up whether or not the sixth chapter was extant. And particularly the 44th verse in some of the pre-Constantine manuscripts of Yahochanan. And it is indeed, it is in parchment 75 and in 66. I think Rod's concern here was that Yahusha would make a statement that would say that no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. Now, of course, he said that in Hebrew, and it was translated into Greek, and now I'm translating it into English, and it's been poorly maintained along the way. But that's the gist of it. And so there are insights that can be gleaned from that, assuming that it's an accurate statement. The first of those is that no one can come to Yahusha. No one can benefit from Yahusha. From the work that Yahusha did, you are immune from its benefit unless you have been drawn to it by the Father. And the reason that that's a valid statement is that unless you know that Yahusha walked out of the pages of the Torah, unless that you know that he is the living embodiment of Yah's teaching and guidance, unless you know that he came here to affirm the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, to explain the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, unless you know that his purpose was to honor Yahweh's promise to fulfill Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah, so that we could become immortal, so that we could become perfect, so that we can become adopted into God's covenant family, and so that we can be empowered and enriched with his Torah and with his Spirit, then there is no way to understand who he is or what he has done, and therefore no way to respond to it and therefore capitalize upon it. And the only way that you can come to understand these things is if you were drawn to this realization by way of the Father's, Yahweh's, Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So it makes absolute perfect sense. It's the point I try to make to Christians all the time. If you don't know his name, for example, if you don't know that his name is Yahusha, you don't know who he is. because you don't understand his relationship to Yahweh or his Yahweh's purpose in sending him. The next aspect of this passage that I like is it reinforces that the Father, Yahweh, sent Yahusha. You know, Yahusha is a diminished and set-apart manifestation of Yahweh sent from him to us. And therefore, those who are fixated on Yahusha don't know Yahweh. You never focus on a diminished manifestation when the diminished manifestation is said, I want you to look at the one who sent me. So that's also an essential part of this understanding. One of the things that I find particularly interesting, it says that that those who the Father has drawn to him by way of his Torah teaching, his Torah guidance, which is how the Father draws us to the understanding of who Yahusha is and what he has done for us. He says that those will be raised up on the last day. Now, what's interesting here is this notion of timing of, therefore, those souls who have chosen to be observant, just as this passage we were considering in the Torah says, those who were observant and who came to learn about Yah's teaching and therefore received his mercy will be drawn up to heaven on the last day. And of course, then when is that the last day and what happens to our souls in the intermediate period of time is all part of what is interesting. Of course, one of the things that this also relates to is the fact that the vast preponderance of souls will simply cease to exist. When Yahusha is speaking in the Sermon on the Mount and telling us that the minority of those who are listening to him will receive the benefit of life, he says that the vast majority will experience death and destruction. Death and destruction of a soul, the elimination of a soul, is not eternal torment. They are mutually exclusive concepts, which means the vast majority of souls simply cease to exist upon their mortal death. And those who have embraced the covenant, they will live, and they will be brought up into God's home on the last day. I'm Yada. This has been Shattering Myths.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that